This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The economy, aging population and national identity are three issues Singapore must work on if it is to thrive in the next few decades, so says Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong. Will the formula that has worked so well in the past half century continue to serve it in the future? As the city-state prepares to celebrate 50 years of independence, we ask Michael Vatikiotis, the Asia Regional Director for the Centre for Humanitarian Dialogue, a think tank that aims to resolve conflicts, about the challenges ahead. Michael, what's the mood like in Singapore in the run-up to this 50th celebration of independence?
Well, it's the middle of the hot season, and obviously it's also a period where, you know, every year Singapore celebrates its anniversary, although this year being rather special, I suppose, because it's the 50th anniversary. Having said that, it's been a year marked by tragedy with the death of the founder of the nation, Lee Kuan Yew. And so while the celebrations are eagerly anticipated, and of course, like everything here in Singapore, well-planned, the fact is that it's a year that has brought a lot of people to reflect on the past as much as the future.
Is that reflection something that you see in the press as well? What's the tone like? Is it introspective or is it, you know, just highly optimistic?
I think there's a great deal of relief. I think everyone believed somehow that the passing of Lee Kuan Yew might herald some form of insecurity or concern about the future. In fact, the transition passed off remarkably well. First of all, I think the government was extremely gratified and pleased that there was a huge public outpouring of respect for Mr. Lee. I think secondly, they've moved very, very quickly to ensure that the transition under Mr. Lee's son, Lee Hsien Loong, is in typical Singapore fashion managed very well. And so we've begun to see a great deal of attention focused on Mr. Lee Jr., Lee Hsien Loong, in terms of his achievements and his plans and his vision. And so I think that's something that's been managed very well. So it's, as always with the Singapore media, which is very well managed, I think it's always difficult to actually judge what people really think. Having said that, you know, I think the mood is generally quite optimistic, although there are concerns about the economy, because we've seen a downturn, particularly in the retail sector here in Singapore. And I think there are also concerns about the future because of the very high degree to which Singapore's growth now depends on overseas immigration.
You mentioned Singapore's sense of organization, which I think is one of its key defining traits abroad. When you think of Singapore, that's what you think of. So when it comes to Singapore's leadership then, what vision do they have for the next 50 years? Do you sense that they have something that's quite clearly defined, or are they floundering or kind of, casting about for what might be next?
I think the first thing to say is that Singapore's been extremely lucky. It's grown an average of, almost 7% for the last 30 years. The economy is still, despite the downturns, despite the lower projections of growth, it's still growing in a neighborhood that's, started to suffer a great deal in terms of, overall prospects. Singapore's doing very well. And so in that sense, I think the government feels that its policies have been vindicated. It's managed to make transitions in a timely fashion in terms of how to deal with shifting demands in terms of manufacturing and services. And Singapore has positioned itself very, very well to become a regional financial center and has also managed to retain some of the sort of cutting-edge manufacturing that other countries have lost the competitive edge for. So I think that the government feels that its long-term, its long-range planning has probably been vindicated. The real concern is more on the demographic side and in terms of how society is impacted by the extraordinary extent to which this growth has actually been a product of immigration, of migrant workers, professionals, service workers, laborers. Country now has more than 1.6 million foreign workers out of a population of 5.5 million. That's an extraordinary number. And similar in many ways, mirroring the challenges facing Malaysia, where more than half the labor force is made up of migrant workers.
What social strains has this foreign migrant worker sort of population caused? And how is that reflected economically?
Well, I think generally, if you look at it from the point of view of a resident or a consumer, it's generally been a good thing. The services are well provided. The construction sector is pumping along. You have a good and fairly sort of mature pool of migrants who've stayed in Singapore for a very, very long time, have gotten used to how Singaporeans and the Singapore economy is served. And so, generally you don't see the kind of social problems associated with a sort of a new and large surge of migrants. Although, having said that, there was unrest in 2013 in Little India, and there has been a great deal of concern about large numbers of construction workers, not just from South Asia, Bangladesh, but also from China, who may be finding it difficult all the time to integrate, given the difference in the conditions they face. But generally, I think the concern among Singaporeans themselves is, it's a question of what the future of their jobs are. In an economy that is so easy to access from the outside in terms of labor and migrants. And we've seen the first signs of concern about what the future is for Singaporeans themselves.
Going back to Lee Kuan Yew earlier, because it's hard to talk about Singapore without speaking of him, he created a paternalistic but meritocratic society. Can the system he built survive in its present form, or does it need to be changed and adapted?
Well, I think the best way to answer that is that it is slowly, slowly, slowly already adapting and changing. I mean, we saw at the last election, People's Action Party, the PAP, the ruling party, lost what it considered to be a significant number of votes. It only had a 60% majority. Now, of course, elsewhere, people wouldn't worry about that. But here, obviously, that's actually a significant inroad into their majority, and it reactivated and animated the opposition, and we saw a more open debate about several of the critical issues that I've just mentioned, and we've also seen in recent months a good deal of concern amongst ordinary Singaporeans about how their wealth is being invested. And I think we're seeing also through the social media a more sort of slightly more strident approach to criticism of the government, albeit within very, very constrained, very, very sort of measured constraints. So I think that change is very, very gradual. And I think in the last election, we saw the media having to adapt to the demand for more information. And therefore, the opposition did need to be covered in a fairer way, which they did do. But in the case of Singapore, one always has to measure these things in very, very sort of small increments. So I think that the government has been prepared for some years to open things up a little bit more, but not to allow a completely untrammeled freedom of expression. And as we've seen with the recent trials or the recent court cases involving bloggers, they're still very, very capable of ensuring that freedom of expression is controlled.
Freedom of expression aside, as confidence in the PAP, wanes slightly after that last election, is it in turn showing signs of being more responsive to populist demands as a whole?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think that, that's going to be the key to their survival, is the ability to stay ahead of the opposition, to prevent it from becoming too powerful a force by simply adjusting and adapting to what's needed, using the ways in which you can in a very small city-state, through whether it's government action or through the policies that they have with regard to society, make considerable changes without having to face sanction for them. at the ballot box. So I think what we'll see, it's possible that the next election will be held as early as next year. And what we'll see is that the government will make these efforts to show that it has responded to what people are concerned about.
With Singapore's opposition being so small and fractured, without proper checks and balances, can the island continue to thrive as a one-party country?
I think most people would say that the answer to that for the time being is yes. Because, you know, another way of putting it would be, if that's the case, how much longer before a single party like the PAP begins to fracture itself if there isn't strong enough leadership? You know, and one of the arguments that some people make is that, well, the real legacy of the passing of Lee Kuan Yew will be perhaps a weakening of the unity within the PAP itself. You know, you could sort of see a rough divide between the sort of the mainly Chinese-speaking people who represent the sort of the rather sort of domestic communities, and you have a sort of more technocratic element that may be chafing at the bit in order to sort of make a few more changes. And so you could see within the ruling establishment a clear divide between those who represent more domestic interests and those who perhaps are, you know, trying to modernize a bit faster than those interests, you know, particularly on the issue of immigration, would want to tolerate.
I'm speaking over the phone today with Michael Vatikiotis, the Asia Regional Director for the Centre for Humanitarian Dialogue. We're discussing Singapore's future challenges. Up next, we address its ageing population, dropping birth rates and economy. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today over the phone is Michael Vatikiotis, the Asia Regional Director for the Centre for Humanitarian Dialogue. And the topic of the day is Singapore's future challenges. Singapore is a rapidly ageing country. Tons of think pieces are written on this, where life expectancy is increasing. What measures has the government put in place to look after its elderly?
Well, the answer is, I think, that this is pretty much still a work in progress. You know, as you've pointed out, you know, there is a very much an aging population. It's not replacing itself. The fertility rates are very, very low. And so for some time now, the government has put incentive schemes in place. Having a baby, you know, it results in a great avalanche of, if you like, public money coming your way, and there are all sorts of incentives for people to have children. But the fact is that people are not having enough children to replace the population. And so I think the government is looking very seriously at how to deal with this problem. I mean, to some extent, it relates back to what we were discussing earlier. I mean, immigration, to some extent, is replacing the population. The population is definitely growing. It's just that Singaporeans themselves are aging and are not replacing themselves.
So, with that, will the government be forced to widen Singapore's social safety net as we have people heading into retirement with longer life expectancies? You know, basically all the issues that would be facing any aging nation.
Yes, I mean, and to some extent, that's already provided for. I mean, you have, as in Hong Kong, you have a sort of a basic welfare net, system, you know, a provident fund. You have healthcare for the aged. And you've started to have for some years now, you know, the provision of facilities to look after older people, and they're experimenting with new ways of doing that in a cost-effective way. And so, you know, typically, as you would expect in Singapore, they're ahead of these issues in terms of trying things out. It's just that the long-term prospects, you know, for what Singapore will look like demographically, are in themselves, you know, controversial.
And with that issue of dropping birth rates and how it affects the labour market, so how do you forecast that moving forward? I mean, where do you see Singapore's labour force being in the next 20 to 50 years?
Well, I think what the government would like to see is that more and more Singaporeans weaning themselves, if you like, off a sort of state, you know, state enterprise-based, you know, large company-based system, and to sort of more of an entrepreneurial mode, you know, startups, innovation, you know, something that, as the paper was saying today in the Straits Times, you know, something that can be called Brand Singapore. Of course, this is easier said than done, and we've seen in a number of Southeast Asian countries how difficult it is to actually get people to sort of take charge of an economy that for so long in many ways has been either on a paternalistic basis or on a state-owned basis, you know, some job for life or institutionally very secure for people. And so to get people to become simply entrepreneurial is not easy. But I think that's what the government would like to see.
Considering that Singapore's economy shrank by more than expected in the second quarter, in what ways is Singapore exposed to global fluctuations?
Well, obviously, always. The fortunate thing for Singapore has been that the bits of the economy, you know, that are very important to a city-state as small as Singapore are mainly in the sort of service, financial services area at the moment, which are doing very well. And, you know, the fact is that Singapore has effectively become, you know, an international and regional financial center rivaling Hong Kong. And there's the view that as Hong Kong becomes more and more engulfed by China, you know, as it moves towards the deadline, towards the end of the one country, two systems, that Singapore is poised to emerge as the financial center for the region, which means that on the one hand, it benefits from all the growth, and on the other hand, it does get buffeted by the ups and downs. Although we are seeing the currency hold up fairly well compared to what's happening in other regional currencies, it's the fact is that Singapore is a very effective foreign exchange trading base right now. The major concern seems to be what's happening in the retail sector, which, you know, Singapore has poured quite a bit of investment into over the last few years. That's not doing terribly well.
How does Singapore stand to benefit from the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, it's a sort of a mixed. I mean, Singapore is a founding and establishing member of the TPP. On the other hand, there are elements of the TPP that would sort of put Singapore into a difficult position with regard to lessening its stake in the economy. I think it's fair to say that you know, that the Singapore has stood by its negotiation of free trade agreements with its major partners. It considers that, you know, it punches above its weight when it comes to these larger economies that it deals with. So I think in many ways, whatever happens, whether the TPP goes forward or not, Singapore is bound to reap some advantage.
As you referenced earlier, the government is trying to wean itself off a cheap labour model and boost worker productivity. Right now, are these measures working? Are they seeing any headway?
You know, I haven't followed it that closely to sort of check, but, you know, one senses that, you know, it's still a work in progress. As I mentioned earlier, you know, that the new trend is towards trying to establish or trying to promote more Singaporeans to become more entrepreneurial and to work in the sort of areas of startups. And there are all sorts of schemes to do that. You know, the other side of the coin is that, you know, there is plenty of labor out there on the move to sort of pick up the gaps and fill, you know, the demand for more productive labor. As I said, the controversial issue is that very often it comes from outside.
What's your opinion when it comes to the government's Smart Nation drive designed to take connectivity, data downloading and tech startups onto the next level?
Well, again, you know, this is part of this modern thrust, you know, to sort of always stay ahead of the latest ways in which economies can grow, particularly in this sort of area of high tech. We've seen very clever moves in this area over the last few years. I think what has really been lacking in a way is any evidence or sense that that the innovation with which, you know, Singapore is invested so heavily is actually making a difference. I think, you know, there is the view out there that however innovative, however much the infrastructure here allows for, you know, the pursuit of these high-tech enterprises, the fact is there are other factors that hinder Singapore's growth in this area, which have more to do with the softer areas of how society develops in terms of initiative, in terms of an education system that allows people, promotes a more entrepreneurial activity and decision-making rather than just sort of listening to a boss. It could be more to do with the human factor than anything else.
Briefly, Singapore's defense budget is substantial. Does it need to be? Why does it feel so embattled?
Singapore would argue that over the years, this has been justified. I mean, yes, you would think that it doesn't really make sense in this particular day and age to keep vast arsenals of aircraft and battle tanks overseas, often very far overseas, when in fact modern-day warfare, you know, is all about a missile in a blink of an eye. So sometimes, you know, whereas they've spent a great deal of money on buying a lot of very expensive kit, you would think that a more sensible way of configuring defense would be to sort of think in terms of the new form of electronic warfare, long-distance, you know, missiles and such, rather than sort of battle plans and looking across the causeway, as perhaps was the strategy in the past. I think what Singapore is doing, probably very smartly, is developing a very, very high-tech navy, which precisely reflects what I was just saying, which is that the new threats are going to come from overseas and from a long distance. And so it's very, very important to have a very smart and very high-tech navy to deal with that, which is what they're doing.
Increasing U.S.-China rivalry puts Singapore in a little bit of a difficult position, as it is a friend to both countries. How should Singapore play this diplomatic game?
Singapore tries very hard to balance the two major powers in the Asia-Pacific, the U.S. and China, and incidentally also now increasingly India. I think what has happened over the last few years is that Singapore's currency as a balancer has somewhat devalued. Indonesia has become a more important, or at least was in the last administration, a more important diplomatic player, particularly for the United States. China is increasingly looking at, you know, at relations with Myanmar, with Indonesia, and with Thailand as essentially determining its position in the rest of Southeast Asia, and perhaps pays less attention to Singapore's position on the critical issues. I think also with the death of Lee Kuan Yew, Singapore has clearly lost a key influencer on the international stage, and one of the areas that the government's going to have to look at perhaps investing in more is how to boost its diplomatic voice, particularly with the passing of the older generation of diplomats who were very much schooled in a very pragmatic approach, but nonetheless were highly qualified. One wonders whether under, you know, the younger generation would be really up to that job. And also one worries, you know, who are the voices, the personalities who are going to conduct that diplomacy on the world stage. I don't think that Mr. Lee Hsien Loong, it's always been necessarily his forte in foreign affairs. And so I think Singapore needs more of a voice and also needs to establish exactly what its balancing role is in the current situation.
With China looming large over Singapore and the rest of the region, what opportunities are there for Singapore to exploit its friendship with China?
I think that, you know, Singapore will continue, as I said, to balance and not to try to seem to be too far ensconced in either camp, China or the U.S., particularly on the thorny issue of the South China Sea. Although what's interesting has been that Singapore has taken a legalistic approach, you know, to this issue, and has a number of people have made some rather forceful comments about the need for China to perhaps use a rules-based approach, an international legal arbitration approach to resolving this issue, which is not something that China has up till now showed much interest in doing.
Finally, some analysts say most creative industries continue to thrive in Singapore despite the lack of freedom of expression. Is this clampdown on dissent at odds with the country's ambitions to foster creative industries, or instead has Singapore shown that the country can grow despite this?
Well, the short answer is yes. I mean, it obviously, you know, if you're a student thinking of coming to study literature or the arts in Singapore at one of the schools that's been set up, you know, you might think twice when you think in terms of, you know, how much freedom of expression there is or is not. Having said that, I think Singapore does try to make sure that these sort of short, sharp shocks that it often gives to people who, in its view, stray beyond what it considers the norms of freedom of expression by its definition, you know, I think that it tries to keep that fairly limited. But I think a broader issue is, you know, thinking about Singapore's future in terms of, you know, can you really create or foster, rather, a creative, dynamic population that is at the cutting edge of whether it's technological or creative thinking? If you don't have an education system that really does promote independent inquiry and thinking, and I think that's the larger issue. It's not the sort of the headlines about who the government takes to court, but more fundamentally whether the education system is generating people who are questioning, are prone to being sort of capable of independent inquiry and innovation and evaluation. I think that's the larger question. But I will say finally, but you know, all that is often, you know, based, or the Singapore government's approach is often based on the fear that if it allows too much freedom of expression, society will be destabilized. I think that's probably less of a fear than they think, because I think I regard, having lived in Singapore for 10 years, the society here is ethnically, religiously, really rather well balanced. It hasn't suffered from any of the problems we've seen of religious intolerance in Indonesia or ethnic and religious intolerance in neighboring Malaysia. It has a rather more healthy plural society at this point in time. And I actually think that the immigration has played a role in ensuring that's the case.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Michael Vatikiotis, the Asia Regional Director for the Centre for Humanitarian Dialogue. We've been discussing Singapore's future challenges as it looks forward to its next 50 years. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.